So we talked about our pain and our way of comforting ourselves physically yesterday, and I thought it might be helpful to talk about our the psychic side of this practice. It's just as big a subject as the body part. And in a way, we really can't talk about it because it's invisible, inexpressible in many ways. And yet, there are experiences that it's helpful to remember and to know how to be with. I remember my first introduction to meditation was at Foothill College. They were giving a course in it. And the very first thing that the teacher said was, "Now we will teach you meditation and then you will become rich. And you'll be able to drive a Cadillac car anytime you want to. You can have anything you like if you just take up meditation." And so I left. I thought, maybe it's not for me after all. This is the wrong thing. And then I sat for a little while with the Quakers. And that was quite wonderful. There was a little Quaker meeting house on my college campus. And on Sunday morning, I would slip in. And the silence was like food. It was so nourishing, especially in the chaos of living in a dormitory. But then someone would be moved by the light to stand up and speak. And it would just drive me crazy. please be quiet. So I gave up on that. I thought, well, that's not meditation either. I guess I'm just not, I don't get it. But then when I accidentally ended up at Tassajara one summer, just exploring a little road that went nowhere, just for the fun of it, just to get to know the lay of the land in California, one of the best parts of that accident was that we learned how to sit and that I heard Suzuki Roshi speak. I often talk about this because it was such a moving experience to me after such a long time looking, even as a child, listening for someone who might know something about it. And feeling that someone must, but I couldn't find it. And there was this little Japanese man in this far-off place where we just found ourselves, and just talking about his childhood. It was nothing profound at all, but I realized that that was what it was that I was looking for, even though it had no name. Still has no name. As soon as we name it, we turn it into something else. So that began a long, many years of practice. And as I think of all those years and all the things that my mind passed through, many of them right here in this zendo and up on these hills. I realized that some of them might be very helpful. In the beginning, I thought that meditation was to get quiet and not think, and really struggled to attain some kind of state, some kind of special state, even though Koban kept saying, "Don't do that." Mm-hmm. there's this urge, and it's a kind of desperate urge in a way. It's part of way-seeking mind that we know we are something. We know there is something, and we don't. And it's a very urgent kind of feeling to find it, to know it, to be it in some way. And yet, without a careful teacher, I think we can easily go off the deep end with that and become ambitious and a little crazy. Fortunately, Coben was always pulling the rug out from under us, so there really wasn't much danger of going off the deep end. It was more the other way. He kept sending us home. He kept saying, go take care of your children. Mm-hmm. And we did that and learned how to domesticate the practice, if you will, in what I now think is a truly wonderful way. In the year that I left Jikoji, there was a little ceremony here for me to say goodbye after, 12 years, I think? Maybe Ryan was there. Maybe Peter was there. And Coben made a little speech. And he called me a transmitted housewife. I just about hit the ceiling. No, I'm a liberated woman. I'm not a transmitted housewife. But looking back, I just think that was right on. Absolutely right on. That our training was really strong and sincere and intense in this space, in Haiku Zendo, everywhere that we ended up as Coben students. But he always made sure that we realized that there's no difference between ordinary and Buddha. That the Buddha practice is the practice of ordinary people and vice versa. That practice is becoming Buddha. Endlessly becoming Buddha. That was very helpful to me. I was grudging about it for a while, but I'm so grateful for it now. And I think it's so interesting because we don't know what American Zen, so-called, is going to be, or American Buddhism. But this is part of the development of it, development of our ability to practice and still be walking on the great white elephant of Samantabhadra out in the world. That we ourselves become a great blessing even as we live our life in the world. One of the biggest lessons I learned in my practice is that there are some things that come up in the mind that need attention, that Zazen itself doesn't fix everything. We used to think that. We used to think we'd be healthy. I know a man who said he was cured of rheumatoid arthritis just by sitting Zazen. I thought, man, that's really powerful stuff. I've often wondered what happened to him. And psychologically, people think, I'm depressed, so I'll just fix my depression by sitting, or some other kind of disturbance. And I certainly thought so. I'm just going to sit through everything. It's like sitting through the pain in your knees. At a certain point, it's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. And to recognize when something comes that's a deep, deep wound, Zazen isn't going to heal it all by itself. It needs much greater attention than just sitting. Koban used to say, well, we don't need psychologists. In Japan, we don't do psychology. He said, we just talk to our best friend. And, you know, so, and for some things, that's very, very helpful. And best friends can act as a psychologist in a way, if there's that kind of trust, deep trust. But there are some psychological conditions that are really need the attention of someone who knows how to walk you through all the way through the nightmare of it. So, in spite of Koban's advice, I always encourage people, if there's a problem that comes up over and over and over again, then it needs some greater attention than we can give in a session. And then, of course, during our sitting, we have all kinds of possibilities of visions. Makyo, little faces in the wall, or funny little animals that suddenly show up in front of your eyes, just out of your own bored imagination. Give me something interesting. So dull. And sometimes people try to develop that and make something out of it. I know somebody who started developing his ability to see color. And he could see red and green and yellow, but he couldn't see blue yet. And he came to me worried about that. He's got these colors, but I can't get to blue. That's the bored mind also. We just can't hardly believe that we're doing what we're doing because our mind and our body both are just so used to doing something else. Just sitting, it just seems inconceivable to a big part of ourself. So, by this time, our mind is becoming a little fuzzy on the edges. We're not so focused on our presence in the way that the way that we pick things up and put them in our mouth or even walk. There's something our attention has turned. We take a backward step and we turn and we're paying attention on both sides. And it gets a little befuddling in about the third day. There's so much going on inside and outside. It's why we organize things so that by the time this happens, that things are pretty orderly and we don't have to think so much about what to do next. We just follow the sound of the han and come to the zendo, follow the sound of the bell and stand up and walk, so that we're not so concerned about what to do. That's very helpful at this point because we need to develop our attention as we can and become what somebody called a conduit, that we actually, as we sit and breathe, that the breath itself and the mind and body itself is all of a piece with and processing everything. It's not that we sit and everything disappears. It's that we sit and everything is with us. Everything. That's why Coben used to say, if you think the people who are at home sitting and drinking a beer in front of the TV, watching the football game, are not practicing, you're making a big mistake. That everyone is practicing with us. So, that's really what I brought to say, but I thought you might have some suggestions about sitting, mind of sitting, as we had yesterday's suggestions about body of sitting, the body of pain of sitting. If gravity is pulling us in a physical way, there are gravities that are pulling our mind as well. And I know how practiced so many of us are, all of us are. This is a most unusual session for me because usually there are new people and it's a kind of starting all over in a different way. This is starting all over in a completely new way, but without having to explain everything. And that's very interesting. And there's so much wisdom and so much experience here that it showed itself very well yesterday. And I was hoping perhaps it could show itself a little bit more today. So if there are questions or things to share, how to cope, what you do, what you have done. I can tell you for myself that I had a recurring nightmare in Zazen for a long, long time. And finally, a friend just insisted that I go find somebody to talk to. I thought, no, I'm fine. It's no problem, it's just a little dinky thing. But then I went and found, turned out to be a teacher as well as a psychotherapist, who is still my teacher today. And it made a world of difference. It changed everything. There are demons. And if we don't recognize and tame them, they will haunt us and make our life a misery. So it's really important to identify and then not hate them. Actually, sometimes we love our demons. We have a hard time giving them up. But it's very well to at least know what it is and then find a way. Can't make anything go away. We just take everything in. But how we are with it is something that can be carefully and kindly dealt with. We need to be kind to ourselves first. Go to a doctor, go to a shrink. Helps. It helps. Beata?
Well, as you know, I have worked with a tremendous amount of emotional pain in my practice. And where I am now is just locating the sensation in my body and then allowing my body to do what it needs to do with the energy of the sensation. Mm-hmm. Because regardless of how I label it, whether I've learned that, you know, I can label it whatever I want. I can call it sadness or grief or fear. I can put 100 labels on it. But it doesn't really matter. It's just energy. And it wants to move. And so I cry. I cry a lot during Zazen. I'm the hanky queen. And, you know, never leave home without one. And it's just the way energy is willing to move. So I just have learned to allow it. That's just part of Zazen.
Yes. But it doesn't move your body. Some people, it moves their body. You know, that the energy is so great that the body just involuntarily does something. And that becomes something to work with also.
Yeah, I went through a long time of that. Mm-hmm. I went through a lot of that earlier, a little early in my practice, where I just couldn't. My body would bolt out of the room, actually. I mean, it's amazing that I'm still here. You know? Only through the great vastness of the people I practice with in Southern California, who would just sort of slowly follow me out of the room and say, so, and just stuck with me through all that. But I was also in therapy, and I'm still in therapy, and just for the sake of the crowd, I'll announce I'm leaving tomorrow afternoon, driving out, and also Thursday afternoon to see my therapist. So I consider it part of my practice, not at all a separate thing from my practice.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you. Malcolm?
I've not sat a sesshin this long before. And what I'm finding is the confidence in my practice is being challenged.
Yes. Oh.
And that's never happened before.
Mm-hmm.
So the confidence that I came in with is being eroded rather quickly. And I recognize that that's part of the... That's not a bad thing, although it's extremely uncomfortable.
Yeah. It's a process.
It is.
And it's cruel. I always say it's like getting dumped upside down and everything that's in your pockets falls out. You know, the lint and the rubber bands and the paper clips and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And you're left with nothing.
You're like, wow, that was in there?
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
It'll last about 10 years.
Yeah. Just starting, right?
I think it's quite a miracle that that I'm still practicing, because I have no idea why I do it. And I mean, there's, you know, some great moments and some bad moments, but mostly it's just pretty ordinary. But there's something really powerful there, too, and that keeps me going. And I have no idea what that is, really. And, you know, sometimes people ask you why you do this, and I haven't come up with any good answer.
Well, it's hard to understand for people who've never experienced it. It's like the nice woman who was interviewing about Koban, and she'd never sat, and she just didn't understand most of Koban's life and intention because she just didn't have that experience and considered it from her cultural standpoint to be very odd. Mm-hmm. In Japan, most people don't sit zazen. Ordinary people. I don't think we need a reason. reason we make up is extra. We can make up we can notice what happens if we have a sitting practice. We can notice that our ability to relate to others is vastly improved, and our understanding, our essential understanding of life itself, life, death, birth and death, becomes less fraught often. That there's a kind of insight that develops that doesn't really have a name, but that allows us to be free of the impediments that keep us from truly seeing with a clear eye. The eye of ordinary people is also the eye of Buddha, but it takes practice in order to be able to see clearly just that. But you don't have to come to Sesshin and say you're going to develop an eye or anything like that. And I don't think your wife would understand if you said something like that. But she knows, just from the way you are.
I guess that's the sort of and yet part, you know, where you can't come with any sort of expectations, because those get so turned on their head, like you say. And while the actual process of sitting, the actual sitting has these moments, good moments, bad moments, boring moments, all kinds of moments. They're always changing. In fact, that's one thing I'm really impressed with this session, is how every sit is so different. Mm-hmm. I mean, not extremely different, but just different, you know. So that if you go into a sit with, like, oh, I want that sit that I had last night. You know, yeah. I think when I first started having nice moments sitting, that I kept wanting those. And so I go, oh, well, this year I'll have lots of those. And I think what you just said is that sort of that very indirect improvement, or what all those things that you want but you're not getting, but you kind of are. That's the sort of and yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I was still sitting the way I was when I first started, I wouldn't still be sitting. You know, we are getting things. I just don't know. You know, it's just so indirect, I guess, or unexplainable, or certainly not logical.
No, there's no logic in it, and no linear logic in it at all. But there's another kind of logic, this kind of logic, the kind that comes from the belly, that makes very good sense and has deep meaning. Meaning about our life itself. About life itself, and how life can flourish, and how it longs to flourish, and way beyond saying it's my life or it's me, it's just life. And our effort is an expression of that. And sometimes we feel it strongly and respond to it and become that conduit, and sometimes we just override it completely and go off and play golf or something. But the more we practice, the more engaged we are as beginning, always beginning our practice as Buddha, wherever we are and whatever we're doing. So that you go home, and home is a Zendo too.
Melinda left today, and this was the first time she'd come and sat with me, after many years. And it was interesting because she said, now, only now, I mean, I've talked about it a lot, but only now does she get what I've been talking about.
Yeah. It's an experience. It's not an idea. And we start out with the idea of it and get caught by all the ideas of it. Sometimes I think the most helpful thing is just to touch our body and stay in touch with the reality of the presence of it, just as we live. That's what Zazen is. It's being the body-mind of the body-mind. I'm so glad she could do that.
She was too. She was, I mean, now she's a meditation nut.
Uh-oh, what have you started?
I couldn't believe how easily she took to it.
Yes.
A lot easier than it was for me.
Tag team on that. Before she left, she stopped me and she expressed her appreciation and gratitude for everyone, and how much she enjoyed the practice and our support. So
good. Good. Well, maybe next time she can sit a few more days.
I think she plans to.
Also on that, there's a story on Koji's website by Eric Remington, and he expressed concern that his wife wasn't sitting, although he was, you know, very rigorously sitting. And Koban said something like, when the husband sits, the wife sits. Mm-hmm. Well, somehow the idea is that whatever is in there is maybe works by osmosis as well. That's what I got off of it.
Mm-hmm. It does. Wherever you go. There's Charlie Ewing's story of how he sat. He came to Sesshin and stopped on the way and had get a cup of coffee and had a very grumpy waitress who was really not nice to him at all. And then he sat the whole Sesshin and stopped at the same cafe on the way back. And he was just amazed at how nice she was. Zach?
Yeah, it's I identify with a lot of what a few people said as far as coming. Well, a comment about coming to Sesshin and confidence in your practice, and it's fun. I mean, you'd think I'd like catch on by now, but I guess like I have a ways to go. It's still like that second and third day comes around, and the second the bottom just kind of falls out, and you're just like, ah. And then the third day, I remember a couple years ago talking to somebody about how it's so hard for me. I go to Sesshin looking for something, and then this really wave of despair that I've always felt when I realize it's not there. It doesn't seem to me, you know what I mean? This thing that, like you expressed it, like I desperately need to touch and have manifested in my life, and to not be able to find it, you know? But you know it's like right there, but and yet it's behind your own eyes, so you can't see it. And it's it is, and it's funny because I'm very interested in not just in Buddhism, but like reading about lots of forms of mysticism, and I always really enjoy reading about where they talk about the dark night of the soul, or this sort of, you know, the cloud of unknowing and these things. But then when you're actually there and you experience that, it's not so romantic. It's not fun. It's hard.
What swear words were intended for.
So, yeah, I don't know if I have anything definitive to say, but it's hard, yeah, when you just realize, I don't even know what I'm doing.
That's really important information.
Yeah.
You know, that's essential. We don't know what we're doing. So we sit with a big question mark around the head and all the way down here and ending with a bop right here. So that the whole body is engaged in the question. It's not a thought thing. It's a physical thing. Good luck. Jane?
Question of despair and grief, and seeming to be this really leaden kind of karmic pain body. And I worked with that for many, many years, and spent most of those years trying tricks with it to make it go away, to soothe it and to heal it and to do just anything I could think of with it to make it go away. And it helped. It gave me some space, some breathing room, and eventually I came to a place where I decided to just let it be. I've never liked it when somebody tried to get rid of me. And so I stopped trying to get rid of me and learned how to just sit with me and to sit beside my grief and accompany my loss and my pain. And not try and do a damn thing about it, except to accept it, that this is the way it was going to be for the rest of my life. And I would breathe into my heart chakra and just feel it. But I had to get to a place where I was a little separate from it. I wasn't being consumed by the pain. There was a little bit of spaciousness there. And some of these tricks the Tibetans have, and various things, breathing the light and working with chakras, they can give you that spaciousness to be able to sit beside something that huge and that painful and just be there, present with it. And in the process of doing that, and the labeling of the weather conditions, the labeling of the temperature, the labeling of the color and the texture, noting the breath around it, all of those. My relationship changed. We gentled each other.